There was something I was going to add after. Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Tom Oakley.
Good to be back.
And together, we're going to explore persistent problems in the classroom. But first, Tom, what you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
Well, I've been reading quite a bit recently. It's been the end of the summer holiday, so lots of suggestions. Been trying to read up on young fiction, all that kind of stuff, and so I've got suggestions for children, but actually, the thing I'm going to share today is something from a while back. I came across it on Threads. So I follow our friend Tom Brassington on Threads, and every day he's been posting something he's been reading. And he posted a link to Ephrat First's blog. And I haven't been on there in a while. And for those people that don't know Ephrat's First blog, it's teaching with learning in mind. And it's absolutely brilliant. And the link that Tom posted was Learning in the Brain. And effectively, it's that. How do we make meaning? How do we get things to go from our short-term memory into our long-term memory? And the other blog post on there that I've been reading recently and I used in preparation for my presentation at Research Ed Düsseldorf was Prediction in Learning as well. So if anybody's unfamiliar with Ephrat First's work, her name Ephrat, Ephrat, First, Furst, it's well worth it. The blogs aren't particularly long. They're really easy to kind of to navigate and get to grips with. And she's got a really effective way of presenting models of learning with graphic images, whether it be triangles building up to make pyramids or connections, those kind of things. So if anybody's not familiar with Ephrat First's work, then I really recommend they check it out. How about you, Kieran? What are you reading for?
Excellent. I mean, it's gold standard blogging that you're referencing there, and I think rightly lauded for the contribution to, I don't know, the general understanding of teachers. So I think, yeah, definitely check it out if you're not familiar already. Mine also pertains to a research ed talk, but it's a research ed talk in the future, next week, by the time this episode goes out. And it's by Ferenc Martin of Variation Theory fame. And it's called Phenomenography, Describing Conceptions of the World Around Us. And the more I read about variation theory, the more I realized that this paper is pretty central. So if you've got time, it's only 24 pages long, and I reckon quite a few of those are references. So do check it out. But Neil and I will be talking about that at the Research Ed National Conference, and perhaps a research ed near you in the future.
Oh yeah, excellent. Excellent thing to read. I'd recently been on the Third Space Learning blog again in preparation for Research Ed, reading about variation theory. Neil's written a really good blog post about variation theory on their blog, and he references Martin, but also the kind of the Bianchi Chinese version of variation theory, and talks slightly about the differences between the two. Fascinating reading. And I think one of the articles I suggested that people read at Research Ed was by Anne Watson and John Mason, and they literally reference Martin Wright at the very start of that, saying this is where their ideas, their theory, their talk, what they're going to mention in the article comes from. So, yeah, excellent.
This week, we're going to chat about persistent classroom problems. It's off the back of a talk, like you say, you gave at Research Ed Deutschland not too long ago. And as I sat there, I thought, I think lots of people should hear this. And I'm going to ask Tom as soon as we finished, basically, that will you talk to me about it? And so I've basically got three questions that I think will help take us through the journey of your talk without you necessarily just doing the talk for us. So I think it makes sense to start with definitions, with an idea of what we're discussing. What are the nine common challenges faced by teachers and then perhaps pupils as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So, for those people that couldn't be there, so in my talk, I talked a little bit about the type of work I'd done previously. So, for those people who don't know me, I used to be a local authority maths advisor. And as part of that role, I worked with teachers, helping them to understand what are the challenges that they come across every day in the classroom that means that teaching mathematics is particularly difficult, learning mathematics is particularly difficult. And then the work that I did as a maths advisor has really influenced the work I do now as a deputy head teacher working at a school in Bury St Edmunds. And time and time again, I'd ask teachers, whether it be senior leaders, teaching assistants, people working in the classroom, what are the things that make learning difficult for children in this subject area? And I would keep a log of these, right? Like I'd go in, I'd write them down because I want to prepare generally for the role. And I also wanted to be able to, when I go from school to school, point people in the direction where people have tackled these problems or they've got solutions to these problems so we can share best practice. Or when I came across research papers, I could point them to them. So I'll get straight to it. What were the things that teachers most commonly said? These are a challenge for me, my colleagues, and they have an impact on students' learning. You'll see there's some overlap between them. But the first was that they often came across children who didn't understand concepts within the curriculum for their year group. Now, we're all familiar with this. We have children in our class, we have a wide range of attainment. I want to teach year three, whatever it is, but there are some children in my year three class who aren't ready for that learning yet. And as we know, the best practice is to make sure that we teach the children what they need next. So if there's a wide range of attainment, then some children might need something different to the rest of the class, or I might need to do something like pre-teaching to bring those children up to speed, and time is re really limited. So that was the first, that there are some children in the class who aren't ready for the content that we want to teach. The next was that there are children in the class who are meant to be on track for their learning, but they've forgotten what has been taught to them previously. And I think whenever I go to a conference or I listen to blogs, one of the most common things that education researchers come up with, and this often gets like a chuckle from teachers in the room, is, you know, that time when you teach children something and you think they've got it, and 2 weeks later, you ask them to remember it and they don't. They had it in the moment, but they don't have it now. And this happens, you know, specifically in English, math, and science. We see it all of the time. You know, the children have been taught this information, but they don't seem to have retained it. So, big persistent problem. Not only does it affect what we want to teach, but all of those references we want to make back to their prior learning when we say, do you remember that thing we learnt in the children look at you blankly and like, right, do I now have to reteach that thing before I teach this thing? So that was number two. The third one is that the children don't yet understand or use the relevant vocabulary. You know, so this particularly pertains to things like if we are teaching definitions or we are trying to get children to generalize or use the properties of something. And we see this all the time, don't we? Children muddling up terms like factor and multiple. And it's either that they don't know the meanings of those words, or they don't know how to use those words, or they can't clearly distinguish the difference between those words. And that really affects the way that they take on what we're teaching them when we use those words. So, of those three so far, I think, Kieran, I think there'll be lots of teachers nodding at home, right? Like, you know, there are children who aren't at that, they aren't in the year group, they've forgotten what they learned previously, or they just don't have the words yet to communicate. Does that ring true with your kind of experience of these kind of things?
Yeah, I mean, in particular, not remembering things. Yeah, I must have spent longer than I care to remember. The point where, we were racing from one to, level one to five, and really, it was performative, wasn't it? But I used to remember, used to bang my head against the wall whenever we did the whatever. I can't remember the name of the assessments we did. There used to be optional QCAs at one
Yeah,
point.
that kind of stuff. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm like, no, what have I done all year? Yes, 100%. And yeah. I think everybody's gonna be nodding along, to be honest, because there's a lot. When you say persistent, I'd find it hard to imagine many situations where it wasn't the vast majority of people in your class who were conforming to these behaviors.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think these are particularly confined to maths, right? You know, like I was a maths advisor, and the majority of the work that I've done in the last 12, 13 years has all been maths focused in the primary level. But you could probably point these things out in most subject areas, you know, particularly in some things that you don't teach that frequently. You know, We're coming around to teaching, it's autumn term, we're coming around to teaching children about plants and animals again in science. So we've done this with, lots of yoga to start with this again. And children just, they might not remember it. So you're like, okay, how far back do I go? Or I'm using the word invertebrate. And the children are looking at me like they've never heard it before. Okay, I need to address that. So yeah, persistent problems, probably not just in maths, but they do affect the way that we present the information and the children make sense of it. So yeah, the next ones on my list is more about the children's behaviors or how we get them attuned to what we're doing in class. So this one came up a lot when I was talking to teachers. Children don't always pay attention to, quote unquote, the important bits of the input or the instructions that we're given, or that children can follow steps like the steps to success, or they can replicate the examples we've been given. But the moment it comes to them applying those things, that's when they fall short. And they might be rooted in the motivational behavioral things. And the one that kind of goes with that is that there are always teachers who will point out that there are some children in the class who would rather be anywhere else. They're at school because they have to be at school. They're in their maths or science or English lesson or whatever, but they'd rather be with their friend who sat next to them outside on the playground. And that's where their attention is. That's what they're focusing on right now. So yeah, those three persistent problems, not attending to the thing that we really want them to pay attention to, the wanting to be somewhere else, or yes, they are following the steps given, but they're not really taking it on board well enough that when the problem isn't exactly like the one we've shown them, there's no transfer there. They can't go with it. And again, I think in these three persistent problems, although it's easy to think of maths examples, they probably translate across the board for most subject areas for most ages of children as well.
What immediately was coming to mind, and it's perhaps just one aspect of the important bits, but it's when we as teachers distract. I'm thinking of when perhaps you dress and roll to introduce some sort of history topic, the Swiss rolls, the biscuits, the Stonehenges. I don't know. Do you think they fall into this category, or is it more a case of, even though you tried your best to direct attention in a certain point, they're still veering away because maybe there's safety in
Yeah,
something. So
absolutely.
if they remember one thing about history, say they knew about, the important dates in Anglo-Saxon Britain, and you were trying to push them towards the connection between, I don't know, we don't really go into 1066, but I'm thinking of maybe, say, perhaps you're making comparisons across the Anglo-Saxons and the Scandinavians at the same time, or perhaps even down into Baghdad and the fact that they had the Norsemen down there and stuff. You're trying to direct their attention there, but they're sticking with Lindisfarne, and that's what they're answering
Absolutely.
questions about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in probably all subject areas, there are those occasions where either you try to add something to the lesson for a bit of engagement or a bit of enthusiasm, and the children remember that bit as opposed to the key learning, or they're so hooked on a part of the input, that's really caught their imagination, like you said, in history, that when you've then changed or transitioned to something similar, but not exactly the same, they haven't gone with you. And that can really affect that kind of meaning making, that sense building, the general larger schema. So when you ask them later to explain what they've understood, they come up with something that you just weren't expecting. Or like in Craig Barton's book, you ask them about the lesson months later, and all they remember is the novelty element, the cutting up the Swiss roll or whatever it may be. And you're thinking, how did that happen? I introduced that element as a hook, but the hook became all they remembered. So yeah, I think persistent problems, sometimes of our own doing, that's something that we've introduced because we think it's the right thing to do. And other times because by the nature of presenting lots of information to children all at the same time, they get to choose which bit that they pay attention to. Unless we are literally gesturing, drawing circles around and saying, this bit, only this bit, focus on this bit. Then they've got free will, haven't they, to choose something else, and that can happen anywhere. So
Do you ever do that? I sometimes do that. I'm all, if you remember one thing from this lesson, remember this bit here. And
yeah,
then.
absolutely. And I think one of the strategies for that persistent problem of how do we get children to direct their attention spend their attention on the thing we want them to is I am Mr. Gestures. I'm doing it now. I can't help but gesture what I'm saying, where I want the children to look. And I'm doing it with colored pens on the board as well. This is the bit I need you to pay attention to right now in this moment. And if you remember anything about this step, it's the effect of this thing. You know, in PE, if the one thing you meant remember about this bit now is the reason why we choose these formations is to restrict the amount of space that the opposition's got. And that's the key to winning this game. If we can control the amount of space that our opposition uses, then that's the thing. And drawing their attention to it over and over, because I can't afford for them not to remember that bit, because I've intentionally designed my path of learning that if that bit's not held, then the rest of this path is going to be really hard for them to follow. So, yeah, it's one of those core bits of advice. I know we'll get into advice in a bit, but yeah, if we don't make it really explicit as to which bits we want them to pay attention to, well, of course they might be looking anywhere else. You know, the Alan Arbour, I think Janet Arbour, her dog in the playground comes to mind. That might be the only thing they remember from school that day. How was school today? Brilliant, dog in the playground, dog in the school, you know, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, easily happen. Right, the remaining three on my list. And these probably do cross over. You know, these might be consequences of multiple things of the book. Children have different starting points for lots of different reasons. It might be that they've transitioned to your school from somewhere else, and that school might have, you know, entirely used a different curriculum path. So they might not have the same learning the children have done, or that child might have had extended periods of absence, or for whatever reason, those children might not have come across the learning that the rest of your children have. The children might have grown accustomed to being really chatty. They love that lively atmosphere. They're really chatty amongst themselves. But you, as a teacher, like the opposite. That for lots of teachers, I was surprised by how often that came up when I spoke to teachers, that the way in which the children behave within the lessons, whether it be their communication, their oracy, drawing them to attention, they've grown accustomed to a certain way, and the teacher found that really difficult. And they always had that kind of internal battle. Do I go with what the children are used to? You know, you're a primary school teacher, you've got these children for the whole year. Or do I gradually change those children's expectations of norms to what I expect? And that might be a battle, but it could be a battle worth winning if it helps some of the other persistent problems, like attention, you know, like motivation, all those kind of things as well. And then the one, this came up specifically when talking to teachers about maths, but I know it applies in other subject areas, is that children don't have reliable recall of core facts that we need them to know, and that it's in there somewhere, but they just don't have that retrieval strength. Lots of the things you need them to have are on the tip of their tongue, or they're just out of reach. So when you need it specifically for the thing you're learning right now, it can slow the whole process down. So you might be wanting the children to focus on one specific thing, let's say, for example, finding remainders after division. And that's the bit you really want to get out of it. But because their recall, their retrieval of division facts isn't strong, it's taken us ages to even get to the ones column, let alone thinking about what a remainder is and all of those kind of things. So yeah, they were the nine things that when I look back over my notes, that came up time after time after time again. And I think the thing that was reassuring is that once I went from school to school to school to school, these were consistent things. These are things that teachers from earlier to year six were telling me. These were teachers with terms worth of experience to decades worth of experience were saying time and time and time again. And for those people who are familiar with Mary Kennedy's Passing the Practice of Teaching, I've probably butchered that title. Yeah, Passing the Practice of Teaching. They relate very strongly to the kind of five persistent problems that Mary Kennedy says that in initial teacher training, we need to make our trainee teachers very aware of. These things are going to be, you know, occurring throughout your career. You're gonna come across these things. You need to be aware that these things can happen unless you're mindful of them. So, yeah, I started the talk going through those nine things in a lot less time than we've just been through now. But I flashed them up and said that when we're talking about persistent problems in the classroom, we need to make it really clear that the things that we find challenging that affect the rate in which we teach, the rate in which children learn, the quality in which the children acquire that learning. They can be affected by lots of different things. And often these relate to attitudinal things, behavioural things, but also one thing that kind of correlates between lots of them is prior knowledge. If those children don't have that prerequisite knowledge you'd wish for them to have at this stage, what you intend to teach them can be really hard going. So yeah, that's how the talk started. And I said, if you are experiencing some of these, at least be, you know, securing the knowledge that you're not alone. So what we went on to then talk about is how we can utilize some evidence-informed strategies to address them, or at least to try and tackle them.
Those last three, I don't want to put any prejudice. I mean, obviously, I think probably everything we say has prejudice attached to it, but mobility within an academic year, or even just within primary, preference for consistency, and an absence of core facts. They feel like they're exacerbated or perhaps more prevalent in areas of high socioeconomic deprivation. You know, of those nine, those three feel like the ones that are, is endemic the right word?
Yeah, and when I did a project, I did a project that unfortunately was curtailed a bit by COVID, that was particularly focusing on improving the outcomes of disadvantaged children. You know, in Cambridge is a big challenge. We want to make sure that those children have as good a chance as anybody to make good progress. But in Cambridge, the gap's wide between disadvantaged and non-disadvantaged children, so it's why everyone's focusing on. But when we spoke to those teachers at the start of that project, those three things came up in almost every single school. And I don't know if it's because those children already come to school with so much baggage, or, you know, if they are prioritizing thinking about other things, if they aren't getting as much support on some of those things at home, or if it's just a combination of those things, that these last few, they might be a cocktail of things that those children in that kind of situation are maybe more susceptible to. But yeah, nail on the head, those children might find those things particularly challenging. And in the school I'm working at now, we see that a lot.
I mean, I know quite a few teachers who decided that whatever strategy that their children's school had in place for learning multiplication tables wasn't effective. So they just taught it themselves and they made them practice every night until they knew them. That's the kind of thing that perhaps doesn't happen sometimes. And then obviously the mobility thing, I think it's more complex than I could possibly articulate. But yeah, I think it's, I mean, all nine of them, you know, are exacerbated by disadvantage. But those in particular seem to be almost intertwined.
Yeah, and I think when I try and help teachers understand what this really looks like, what the implications are for the teacher to think about, we can really break it down to kind of in three things. Some children, for various reasons, find the content that we want to teach them right now particularly difficult to make sense of. Making sense of it's really hard to do. You know, developing really good storage strength and retrieval strength is really hard to do, and actively takes hard work on behalf of the learner. So the child has to be invested, but they also have to have the opportunity to think long and hard about these things. And then the third part, way to think about it, is our challenge as the teacher is to reach into those minds of the children and find out how they've made sense of the things that they've learned, how they have built this into their existing understanding of the concept, or added it to their mental model, if you will. And when you think about it from that point, some children find it hard to relate to or to make sense of. Some children find the process of making sense of it difficult to do for various reasons, and us finding it hard to figure out what they know. If we can find a way of teaching that solves those problems, makes it easier for children to learn, gives them opportunity to think hard without putting them off, that motivates them to keep going and reveals their understanding, then we are so much closer to that ideal goal of us developing their understanding of the concepts, processes, procedures we want them to understand and build as they go through school. So if we can find strategies, tools, techniques that tackle those persistent problems, we're doing something right.
It sounds pretty bleak, but having seen the talk, I know that it's not necessarily that bleak. What can we do to overcome these challenges?
Yeah, so the kind of the light that shines in us that really helps is that in the last, I'd say, 7 to 8 years, we've seen a real growth in writing, accessible educational writing aimed at the teacher that says how we can make learning a little bit easier, how we can make thinking deeply, not a better phrase, maybe, I don't know if there is a better phrase, and understanding what children have made sense of easier. And I pinpointed some great sources of writing that make some otherwise opaque academic writing easier. So lots of people will be familiar with the writing of Craig Barton. Craig Barton has tried his absolute hardest to weigh up decades of research writing and think about what the implications are for practice. So I'm not suggesting that all teachers go out, buy Craig's book and read them through. They are hefty tomes, but if there's something you want to read in that, exacting detail, then Craig's website, Craig's podcasts, they're good places to go to start. And one of the things that comes up in Craig's teaching time and time and time again is the idea of how we can intentionally use sequences of examples to help children notice the structure of the mathematics that we're teaching, comment on the structure of the mathematics that, and the, what they've noticed, and then articulate what they anticipate that means in terms of a generalization or an application. And in his more recent book, he talks about what would that look like when we reflect on something. So the classic, what have I noticed about? Then what we've checked, I would say we've followed the steps that we know, those small steps, and we've broken it down. We can then make some sort of prediction. We can then make an assumption about what that application might look like. And then we can go through and then explain how that's gone. And there's some really great research underpinning Craig's writing there. And it comes up in the writing of Mark McCourt in Teaching for Mastery. It comes up in the writing of Michael Persons, Teaching Math with Examples. It comes up in Ollie Lovell's writing. And we see it outside of maths as well. We see it in the blogs of Tom Sherrington. So the one thing that I shone a light on for a lot of the teachers in the room at Research Head Dusseldorf is that if you recognize that you have some of these persistent challenges and you just hone on in on one of them, there are places to go. And there are strategies that we can look at that we can at least think about applying to our practice to make some of these challenges less challenging. So yeah, that's the way that I started. And I went a little bit further and suggested that some of the strategies that teachers might choose to use is variation. And again, I know this is something that, has been blogged about in lots of detail, but there are still tons of teachers who don't really understand what variation theory is. So I talked a little bit about what variation theory is and the implications for when we introduce a concept or a procedure by highlighting similarities, making differences so those similarities are easier to discern, and talking about boundary conditions so we know how far the extent to which this definition or generalization can go before it's no longer that thing that we're learning about. So, talks about variation as one of the tools that we can use to make learning a little bit easier without entirely removing cognitive load. Again, at Research Ed, we had fantastic talks throughout the day. But one of the common themes was, yes, we're aware that learning can be cognitively demanding, but the aim isn't to remove the cognitive demand, it's to optimize it. So yeah, we want to make the learning easier by relating it to what the children notice, what they know, and how this links to what they've done previously. So for teachers who aren't yet familiar with variation theory and some of its applications within maths, that was the first place at which I directed teachers to start thinking about, and I shared some of the research and reading and accessible things. And again, Neil Almond's blog, I mean, it's been recommended by Peps McRae and his snacks for those people that subscribe, so it must be pretty good. Neil's written it and Peps recommends it, so it must be a great place for people to start.
Well, I mean, this is why me and Neil are doing a talk together. I've got a put him, bring him back down to earth. You know, he started getting ideas above his station, so sort of put the chains on him. I mean, with variation theory, I spend a lot of time talking about how it's a luxury piece of our pedagogy, you know, in terms of when I'm not teaching well, there are other things I can focus on which will give me more impact in the classroom for less sort of cognitive effort, although they will still require effort. Where do you sit on that continuum?
Variation theory requires a really good understanding from the teacher of what we're varying and why we would choose to present something with varied examples. So, for those teachers who recognize that something is difficult for children to comprehend, either because the steps involved are so great that we're going to need several lessons for this anyway. Or it's something they've taught time and time again, you know, oh gosh, year three, learning to tell the time, or year four, negative numbers, or whatever. They always find that difficult. In those topics, if you are not carefully varying your examples or your context in which you're presenting your examples, you probably are setting those children up for a slight fall in the sense that you're making it harder for them to understand what these steps are. So when you progress to your next learning objective, learning essential, whatever you call it, you are hoping the children have carried that with them. And if they haven't, they're going to find each consecutive step harder to go. In those cases, variation theory can be a great friend, right? Because there are always going to be those children who, let's take an example outside of maths, for example. There are always going to be those children who aren't sure where to place an apostrophe. They know what an apostrophe is because it's on the board, or they've seen other people use them in their writing, but they're still struggling over why I intentionally place one where and when. Or because there are conditions on sometimes an apostrophe is here and other times it's here. And they just can't gather rhyme or reason why in some words it's in between letters. In other words, it's after the word. In those cases, I think variation theory is worth persisting with. The caveat that comes with it is if we are going to intentionally sequence examples and we're going to get the children to discern the difference, recognize the difference, comment on their difference, create an example like it, that takes time, right? That is extending your we do period or your guided instruction or whatever. So it's got to be worthwhile. And like you said, there are other techniques and strategies that can get to that same outcome that might be quicker, might require less cognitive effort from the child. They might increase the pace of our lesson, and we might get on to the application sooner. So it's a really personal thing to think about. When is the time to do this? And if you are a novice teacher, you're new to teaching and you haven't taught, or you've changed your group and you haven't taught these things before, there are clues out there as to which things children find difficult to pick up. You can talk to previous teachers, you can look at your assessment spreadsheets or whatever, and you can see those things that aren't all green. You look at your heat maps and see where those challenging learning objectives are, and you can think, hold on a second. Is this a position in which variation theory might really help me out? Is this one of those small steps that really isn't that small? We need to go slow now to go fast later. And I think that's where I sit on it. Variation theory isn't something that is worth applying every day because the opportunity cost can potentially be too high. But it's one of those things that, when applied well, can really pay dividend later. So that when the children are presented with a situation that's not exactly like they've seen, they've formed enough of a generalization that they can make an educated guess and they can back up their reason why they've placed their apostrophe where they have, or why they haven't exchanged in the tens column and they've done something different instead, for example.
Yeah, so I mean, those big ideas, persistently troublesome. I think, you know, fields like variation theory and threshold concepts. I'm pretty sure Meyer and Land have been referenced in the variation literature quite a bit. Feels like that's almost your point. Do you think actually this is something that's going to really change how people see the world, or how, certainly how they see the discipline? Let's go for it there. I like that. I think that's yeah, because you know I'd love to use it every day, but I've only got what 2.5 hours to plan. So
Yeah, and I think the thing is that variation theory on its own can't be achieved through a worksheet, and it can't be achieved through just throwing up three questions in a row and assuming the children are going to discern the difference. I think for those teachers who have become senior leaders or middle leaders, and you've done book looks and you've talked to children about their learning, you might ask them about consecutive questions and say, "What do you notice about those two questions? What do they have in common? What does that make you think about this?" And children might not have gone into that level of detail because they were presented with those four or five questions in a row without really having the prompts to go, "Oh, hold on a second. There's an intentional reason why my teacher's followed up that with that." So actually, my answer to question six, for example, can't be that because the question's almost identical to question five, but my answers are so different. And I think we have to bear in mind that variation theory, like lots of the other things I talked about, it's not a silver bullet. It's not a medicine that works for every illness kind of thing. It's something that has to be done really intentionally, and we have to draw the children's attention to some of these things. One of the things that I often think suggest to teachers is that although there's lots of utility in the question, "What do you notice?" the goal is sometimes too wide, and it might be better to ask, "What do you notice about?" so that we can help them discern, actually, the thing I need them to be thinking about right now is this part over here. And for anyone who's ever taught early years, Key Stage One, and you've just asked the question, "What do you notice?" without any context, the answers you can get back can be anything. You've just presented two lovely worked examples on the board. You ask the children, "What have you noticed?" And the first response is, "You're wearing different glasses today." Okay. All right, yeah, you've noticed it, but now our next 5 minutes is not going to be about what I want it to be about. So yeah, I think a worksheet alone isn't going to do it. We have to be really intentional about it, and we have to make the effort to draw children's attention to likeness or where likeness might have occurred so that they can make those connections.
Without fail, every time I'm teaching an unfamiliar reception class or nursery class, the question, "What do you notice?" will be met with, "You're bald."
It's noticeable, Kieran. If you are four or five, it's noticeable. So yeah, you've got to be really specific with what you want them to comment on.
We got variation theory. What other possible ways can we overcome these persistent problems?
Great. So one of the things that we can do to engage children with thinking deeply about their learning and thinking about how it relates to what they've learned previously is to utilize prediction in the classroom. Earlier in the academic year, I'd talked to a MathConf event, and I talked about my preferred way of teaching children to read the time. And this is a really good example where asking questions which require children to predict what will happen when we make a specific change can be really powerful. And again, I made reference to Ephrat First's blog in this, because the key thing about prediction is that as humans, we are predicting all the time. All the time. And it's how we can make sense of the world. And when we predict something that doesn't come true, if we then think hard about why that outcome was different to what we expected, we are forcing ourselves to question our existing schema, our existing understanding of that concept, that notion, that idea. Yeah. So again, we're thinking about teaching early as a Key Stage One, and the children understand very limited amounts about gravity. You know, the idea that there is something pulling us down, because we're doing a unit about pulls and pushes, and we're not all floating off in space. And the children might be thinking that if you let anything go, it's going to drop. Whatever that thing is, you let it go, it's going to fall down. But for children with previous experience of helium balloons, they know that's not always the case. Their prediction might not be the same as everyone else's prediction because their prior learning tells them otherwise. Their previous experience says, "Hold on, that's often true, but not Always the case. And I think that prediction is often underused in our teaching, but it can be a really highly powerful hinge question, or at least something that can be used as a formative learning strategy for the teacher to gather, are these children on the same track as me? I've got 29 children in this class. 27 have predicted them that after the clock says 9:59, it's gonna say 10:00. But I've got this group of children over here who are fully expecting it to say 9:60. If I don't ask that prediction question, I might not find that out. And then if the children are really confident, I know you've talked before about weighted multiple choice questions, you know, that kind of, if they're really confident their prediction's going to be true and they find it's not, then the hypercorrection effect, something I know has been talked about in the podcast before, can come into play. And they think, oh, hold on a second, I'm never going to forget that now. And for people who aren't familiar with that hypercorrection effect, if you've ever been at a pub quiz and you've been the person on the team that says, no, the capital city of Australia is definitely Sydney, and everyone on your table is against you, and you write it down anyway. And then it turns out it's not, and you're like, oh God. You never forget it because you remember that kind of how adamant you were and that you were proved otherwise. And two, it forces you to think about, well, how certain am I about the related facts that go with that as well? Maybe I won't be as confident next time. Maybe I'll do a double check before I persist with someone. So a prediction in learning can be really helpful because it forces the children to make connections about what they've noticed about that thing now and how it relates to what they've learned previously. And it also acts as a brilliant checking for understanding tool for the teacher. And I know in Sarah Cottingham's book that I've got here, because I'm going to get the title wrong, Algebra Bell's Meaningful Learning in Action, she makes a distinction between checking for understanding and checking for meaning. Are the children really just understanding at a surface level? Are they just parroting back what I've said or the definition on the board? Or are they going deeper than this? Are they saying what they're saying because they've got a strong reason to do so? They've made a link to something they already know. Whether they've presented that through, I think in Sarah's example, she uses mind maps or whatever. I think this is going to happen because I already know this to be true. And I think this thing we're learning about now follows in the same way. So I predict that, or I believe that, or, you know, that kind of thing. As a teacher, to get that kind of feedback, we're tackling two of our potential challenges at once. One, we want to make the children think hard about their learning. And two, we want to know what they're thinking about the learning. And again, if anybody's unfamiliar with Efrat Firth's blog, she's written two blog posts about prediction and learning that are based on a research ed talk that she did in 2020 about how our brain responds when we predict and the prediction comes to be true or when it doesn't, and how that affects the way in which our learning develops and our schema changes over time. So I'd really encourage teachers to think about when might prediction be a useful thing in learning to help children really think about the application of the concept, the procedure, or the train of thought that we're going. How can I go from just this example I've seen to a more generalized understanding, to that understanding in action, that applied learning? Prediction potentially is really powerful there. Again, the caveat is if we're going to slow children down to make these predictions, share that exploratory talk as Neil Mercer and the RSET team at Cambridge University say, and then, you know, think pair share or cold call. Again, it takes time. So when is it worth doing this? When is prediction worthwhile? So yeah, the second thing that I shared is that is prediction, the power of prediction for making children think really hard about how our learning now relates to what they've previously learned. And then explaining where they're at in their thinking, whether it be just that they're choosing choice A, B, C, D, or whatever, or writing something in more detail. I think prediction has a lot to offer, not just in maths, but in other subject areas too.
I mean, it feels implicit in what you're saying. Is prediction on its own sufficient, or do the actions of the teacher when they take on that information you talked about, Does that come up in the literature? You know, it's how we then act on this information, or do you think that psychological phenomenon is sufficient on its own?
I think, again, prediction's particularly useful in an intentional sequence of problems. And it's really useful if you're asking them to predict, and there are future questions that follow, right? You know, so if we were asking that question about what comes next on the clock after 9:59, and then the children realize that it's not 9:60, it's 10 o'clock because, and then I ask more questions where the same thing happens. I'm changing the number of hours, but I'm repeating the 59. So I now have an opportunity for the children to do something with the information they've received. And again, it all links to the research that exists about feedback, immediate feedback, actionable feedback, and opportunity to act on feedback. Prediction provides an opportunity for that child to receive immediately actionable, specific feedback. And we know the power that feedback can have when presented in the right way, in an actionable way. And if any teachers are thinking about marking, you know, starting that new school year, how do I reduce the workload that comes with marking? The more and more you can give that immediate, actionable, specific feedback in the lesson, you're going to see not only impact on your workload, but on the children's rate at which they make sense of their learning too. And prediction is just one of the means at which we can provide opportunities for that. So yeah, there's real crossovers there in the research between prediction, hyperpredictive effect, feedback and marking, but also that's only possible if you think about the order in which you present your questions and taking the time to do so. You know, I'm sure whenever anybody thinks about those kind of really important formative assessment questions, those hinge questions, in their mind, they're thinking about the what ifs. If my children all answer this way, what do I do about that? And if they answer this way, what do I do about it? And if I've got a split, right? If I've got some of my class thinking it's one thing and some of my class thinking it's another. And again, there is loads out there at the moment. Hot topic right now is that adaptive teaching, right? You know, that kind of I'm in the moment. I think I need to do these things to make the learning accessible. If this thing happens, I need to, whatever it may be, increase the amount of scaffolding, reduce the amount of scaffolding, change the task. And I think that there's sufficient research out there to suggest that when paired with immediate actionable feedback within an intentional series of questions, we can meet some of those dual aims of helping the children make sense of their learning and making sure that we can direct our support where it's needed most.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic response, and I think it'd be particularly useful in helping guiding people's decision making because it shows you the connection between all those different parts and things, you know, and especially where, you know, like you said, and I think you said today, and you said during the talk, comorbidity and some of the initial problems causing some of those later ones in the certainly in the way they've been sequenced in the way that Mary Kennedy might sequence them.
And I think the third one's self-explanation. I know you've heard Michael Pershing on talking at length about self-explanation. Self-explanation, I think, comes into the other two, right? We are wanting the children to do that really important meaning making. We want not only good story strength, you know, really strong understanding of this idea, but we want to develop good retrieval strength too. We want the children to make really sound understanding of what they're learning right now, and we want it to be easy enough to remember and apply later. And in Michael Pershing's episode and in webinars he's done for Lumen and other places, and I know in the past that Bethany Rittle Johnson's been mentioned on the podcast before, in lots of research there's lots of promising things that go back to like research from the late 70s, early 80s that says children make sense of what they're taking on board by explaining how it relates to what they already know. So self-explanation from the teacher's point of view is, how do I help children get better at explaining to themselves how this learning relates to what they already understand? So variation provides us opportunities to do that because we do the noticing, the similarities, the talking, that prediction helps us to do that as well. And in maths, there is a lot of opportunity for self-explanation under reasoning and problem solving. Yeah, so when we think beyond fluency and we think about the general understanding of a mathematical concept, process, idea, and the utility of that, how far is this procedure, this method applicable beyond just the examples my teacher's shown me now? And there is enough research now that says that this is something that we should be talking about. Like, no one's saying that this has a huge impact on children's learning by giving over time for this. It, you know, the research says it has a moderate impact, and lots of things have moderate impact on children's learning. But if this is what is going on in our brain, if we are self-explaining how this experience, this concept relates to what we know, and we can help children get better at that, we're effectively introducing routines that support the long-term retrieval and transfer of our learning. So I think I said in the talk that self-explanation is one of those things that we often don't give enough time to in our maths lessons. And if we look through our maths exercise books, we might not see a lot of it at all. And in my own practice, before becoming an advisor, before working overseas, it would be frequently commented that my maths books looked different to other people's maths books. And I don't necessarily know that, you know, I don't think I was aware of the term self-explanation, but I was always adamant that my classes, and I predominantly taught Key Stage 2 and Upper Key Stage 2, I was adamant that my children would have the opportunity to explain to themselves what they've taken away from today's lesson, how it links to previous lessons, and how it might be useful in the future. So I might put self-explanation prompts upon the board, highly scaffolded self-explanation prompts upon the board, that might say, how does your learning today about prime factors relate to your earlier understanding of factorization? Use the following words. Here are two suggested sentence stems. And I would give over maybe 5 or so minutes in the lesson for children to do so. And on those particularly tricky ones, I might give the children time to do that exploratory thinking on their whiteboard, sounding out time with their partner next to them, just so they can hear their idea out loud and then go back to their whiteboard and make those corrections, have that table discussion and then put it in their books. And with older children, it's a routine that if you give over enough time is well worth persisting with, because it's not only metacognition, you know, I'm thinking about my thinking and how it relates, but it's also understanding that maths in this instance is a subject of communication. I'm solving these problems for a reason, or I'm presenting this thing in a way that's actionable. I'm looking for a generalization so that in the future, when I come across similar problems that aren't exactly the same, I've got a toolkit. And again, it's one of those things that takes time. It's worth doing. And you need to, I think you need to try doing it as a teacher too, right? You know, if you're going to teach what a factor is, have a go at writing down your definition and how you might explain that with examples and what your non-examples might be. It's not easy, right? And unless it's something that we practice regularly, children might find it tricky to do. And I know that the year fours, fives and sixes that I did with this time and time again probably weren't getting proficient at this in the way that I wanted them to until Christmas time, February time. But having frequent opportunity, modeling good practice, sticking them under the visualizer, talking about it, those kind of things, it really pays dividends. And, you know, I often found that I'd have teachers of the, you know, the next year group come back to me and go, gosh, your class really understand the difference between area and perimeter, or, you know, your past class really, really know what factorization means. And they can tell me what it doesn't mean as well. And it's those things, again, I particularly used it when I knew it might be something that's not necessarily easy to describe first time round, but it's worth persisting with because it's going to be useful later. So yeah, there are some caveats with self-explanation. There are some things that are like, hold on a second, we can't use this all the time and every time. And there's been some meta-analyses on self-explanation. Again, Bethany Russell Johnson's written tons about this, and I think, yeah, so self-explanation came up in the Dunlosky and I'm gonna forget the name of the paper from 2013. Dunlosky, Rawson, Willingham, and others, 2013, improving students' learning with effective learning techniques. Their second recommendation was self-explanation. Now, and that paper's from 10 years ago, and their recommendation for using a highlighter for important information has since been debunked as a thing we shouldn't really do. And that's a conversation for another time. But, people have been talking about the power of self-explanation, how we can use it, and the limitations it can have for a while. So if this is something that teachers think might be useful for them, I'd say check out the Michael Pershing episode. Absolutely wonderful episode. Google Bethany Rittle Johnson, but particularly read the paper from Bethany Rittle Johnson and Abby Law from 2016, another one from 2017, that talks about the constraints of when self-explanation aids learning. Because it's not an all time, every time, do it in any old way and it'll work method.
Could you imagine if every lesson had to have self-explanation in
Oh
it?
my gosh.
That's the wrong
Oh.
kind of cutting through. Because you said you think it's going to be the next evidence-informed explosion. Do you reckon it's got the legs?
I think it's one of those things that it could be taken on board like retrieval practice if teachers see the application and see the benefits when they look back. When you reflect on your practice at the end of a term, end of a year, and you go, how did I make that learning stick? I think with enough effort and enough opportunity for children to get good at it, it's one of those things that could potentially compound over time. Imagine you started bringing in even basic self-explanation, non-written, that verbal self-explanation in year one and year two, and your children were starting to record those in year three with sentence stems and all those kind of things. If that persisted through your school by year four, five, and six, how eloquent could your children be when it comes to definitions, to proofs, to all of those kind of... It's got legs if you persist, I think. And again, if you use it in the right ways, in very briefly, the four recommendations that come out of the papers for self-explanation: scaffold high quality explanations, explicitly teach with examples and the key vocabulary, show what good explanations look like and give children opportunity to comment on them or write their own. Design self-explanation prompts that don't sacrifice attention to important information within the lesson. If I'm only getting the children to self-explain about something, but that's not everything I need them to think about in this lesson, there's a good chance that they're going to take their eye off that other thing as well. So don't design prompts that only focus on part of the key learning in that lesson. These next two, I think, happen quite a bit in a lot of published math schemes anyway. Prompt learners to explain correct information, why it's correct. That we see that quite a lot. And prompt learners to explain why common misconceptions are incorrect. And I think those kind of things, we might see those, they exist in things like White Rose, they exist in things like the Inspire scheme and Power Maths and other things too. They're already happening. It's the bit where children write decent explanations without waffling and without going into extraneous detail and going into tangents. And I think that needs to be taught really well. But that isn't just a maths thing, that's a writing. That's a writing thing. What's my point right now? How can I explain that point in sufficient detail without going off tangent? And can I provide a sound example or series of examples that mean these are the conditions of which I think this works? And again, the Michael Pershing webinar talk that he did for Lumen, the Loughborough University, he talks about to doing that and crafting that and doing it with children in different year groups. So if anyone's really wanting to geek out about self-explanation, then I've given you a few suggested avenues to go down. The easiest to start with might be listening to Michael on the podcast, watching his Lumen webinar. And if you're really taken with it, then follow it up with those research papers, the Donoski, the Rittle Johnson, and think about what that means in your practice. I'd love someone to be like the next Kate Jones in retrieval practice and make this into an easily accessible guide for schools and those kind of things. I'd love that to happen. I'd love that drive to happen in education. Will it happen? I don't know. I'd like to think so.
I think if I remember correctly, teaching math with examples covers this in quite a bit of depth. So that really, Michael, should be the one to carry the torch.
He's written some great blog posts on it too.
Yeah.
Really, like really, really good blog posts on it. And he writes in a way that's easygoing. You know, he's talking about serious stuff, but you can almost read it as if he's got a smirk on his face. You know, he's like this. Come with me on this. Come with me on this. So yeah, he's a good person to start with that, definitely.
Yeah, what's his Substack called? Is it Pershmeal? Is that just, is that
Yeah,
sufficient?
Pershmallow's a great. You get some random stuff in there, but yeah,
Yeah,
no.
it's new shapes that he finds and things like that there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an
Perfect.
absolute shape geek. So yeah, I love all of that stuff. You know, not quite to Ed Southall standards. You know, that guy. You know, I've listened to him talk about shapes and where they get the names from and random shapes and those kind of things. But yeah, I think him and Michael Pershing would really get on in, you know, a niche conversation about shapes that you never really encounter, but they exist.
Yeah, I mean, this is our audience. We are the nerds, and we're proud of being nerds. Were we talking
Absolutely.
research yet about the difference between a nerd and a geek? I can't remember whether you could fall into both parts of the Venn diagram. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, yeah, 100%. Check him, and he's also quite prolific on Twitter. So if anyone wants to has a question for him, you know, fire away. But yeah, the Bethany Rittle Johnson stuff as well. I mean, Bethany writes so well, and I always find it really informative papers. You know, sometimes you can read papers and you think, oh, wow, I'm just wasting time. But I'm actually a big fan in general, because, you know, the investment of time is important. And if you come away feeling you've got something of value, that's always appreciated.
Yeah, I think it's also worth saying if people are interested, Ollie Lovell had Alexander Renkel on his podcast. Is it ERRR podcast? And they talk for a good like hour and 45 minutes about the applications of this, you know. And that's this literally what Renkel does. He thinks about how we can apply what we think the best evidence is into practice and those kind of things. And lots of their conversation talks about secondary school examples and higher examples, but it really does have legs if you're willing to give it the time and space. But as always, as with prediction, as with variation, we have to think opportunity cost. Is this the best way to make use of our time? If we're doing this, what are we not doing?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way to sum it up, because you've got this potential big gains, but potential big time investment too, particularly in the training of both staff and pupils. So I think that's a really nice way to round it off, because, you know, it's about identifying which of these problems are most persistent, most troubling for you, and then what are our options in addressing those. And then I think over an extended period of time, getting to the point where you feel like you're addressing most of them pretty consistently. And I suppose that equates to good learning, I think.
Yeah, and literally that was my role as an advisor, was to help teachers think about their range of persistent problems, identify one, think about the cause of those problems and which ones that we can influence and how we can do something about it. And then over a sustained period of time, think about putting something in place that might have a measurable, noticeable difference. And as always, if I'm bringing something in, I'm taking something out. You know, there's only so many hours, minutes in a lesson. There's only so many hours in a day. I can't squeeze all these things as well as everything else. Otherwise, that 50-minute maths lesson has now become a 2-hour 50 maths lesson. And the children got tons out of it, but it's tons out of something particularly small that may not have great benefits later. So, yeah, you know, if you have some of these persistent problems that we thought about and one of those ideas makes sense to you, then dedicate time to it. It will be worth doing. If you can really think about when, where, how to put it in, and if you have questions about it, then get in touch. You know, like you said, Michael Pershing's out there, great person to go to. Ephrat First, great blog to read. And you know, I think almost everybody I've mentioned today is on social media. I don't think I could have ever predicted how helpful the education community can be on social media for answering those really niche questions. If you find the right person to ask a niche question to, you can get an absolute goldmine of information, or at the very least, they can point you in the direction of something to read or someone else to speak to. So reach out.
Nice. And obviously, Tom, you're on both Twitter, and it sounds like you're on Threads too. Yeah, you were trying to convince me that Threads was somewhere I should spend my
Well, it's
time.
one of those things, isn't it? I mean, I'm hesitant to call it Twitter now because X is so different from the Twitter I signed up to. I will see as many adverts as I'll see useful posts and all of those kind of things as well. And there are those times when what started off as a well-meaning debate can end up in a bit of a back and forth that can get a bit out of hand. Whereas my experience on Threads so far has been largely pleasant. If people have challenged an idea or thought, it's been done with that kind of open idea of, well, tell me what your idea is based on. Where does that come from? As opposed to that kind of shooting down and all those kind of things. So it might not be for everyone, and Threads might not last. But at the moment, it seems like a really a pleasant environment, and kind of feels like what Twitter felt like in 2013, 2014. So
Yeah, we'll see what happens. I mean, I'm sticking with Discord.
it's great that, and I imagine that most people who listen are signed up to Dappy Discord, and if they're not, then they really should, because what an amazing community you've got back here. And that there is never a question too niche. There is never a tangent too obscure that someone won't come and come to your aid and answer on those kind of things. It is amazing. I think in terms of that kind of reaching out and helping, I think the Tadapi Discord's unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, we've even got a mechanical engineering channel in which Atoll will send me images of planes almost crashing as I'm boarding flights. It's almost as if he knows my schedule.
Yeah, and you have everything from that to the whole, I want to know more about the difference between teaching comprehension strategies and teaching reading comprehension skills. What is it, and you can have that full range, and it's an entirely supportive environment. So yeah, big shout out to the Tadapi Discord.
Awesome. I mean, we could probably talk for hours, Tom, but I've been talking all day and I need to give my poor tongue a rest because I've got more talking to do tomorrow. All I have to do is say thank you very much for joining me. Thank you for being the final chat guest before season six, which kicks off next week.
My pleasure. Looking forward to season six.
Yeah, big drum roll. Or maybe I'll add it in a drum roll. And to everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.